The Tom Woods Show, episode 2059.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, folks, if you have had it up to here with the COVID irrationality, you are going to love my free ebook, COVID Charts CNN Forgot. Pick it up at chartstheyforgot.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am fresh from a trip to Amelia Island, Florida over the weekend, where I had the pleasure of speaking at a conference at the Ritz-Carlton there held by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which occupies an interesting position in the history of American conservatism and libertarianism. ISI publishes Modern Age, for example, and we have Dan McCarthy, the editor of Modern Age, on from time to time. That was founded in 1957, and that journal has published all kinds of conservative and traditionalist authors, but also libertarian authors. Murray Rothbard has been published in there. Rothbard's books have been reviewed in there. I've been published in there. So it's a very eclectic and interesting scholarly journal. The Institute itself was founded in 1953, but not as the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. It was founded as the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists. And it was founded by Frank Chodorov. Now, if you know anything about the history of the libertarian movement, that name will be familiar to you. Chodorov wrote a number of books, The Income Tax, Root of All Evil being one of them. He also published a newsletter called Analysis. He was friends with Murray Rothbard. He was very, very much a radical libertarian. He founded the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists in 1953, and the first president was William F. Buckley Jr., who, of course, became later on not exactly Murray Rothbard's best friend. So it was an interesting moment in the history of conservatism and libertarianism that at that moment it seemed as if the sides had enough in common that they weren't even really being distinguished all that heavily. But that would come to an end as the 1950s progressed and into the 1960s, when the Cold War really attracted a great deal of support on the political right. And it was a small minority of libertarians like Rothbard who were concerned that the Cold War was going to lead to lasting negative consequences in the United States. Now, there were quite a few politicians who held that view, right-wing Republicans who held that view. Howard Buffett, for example, Warren's father, who was a congressman from Nebraska, held that view. Robert Taft, to a lesser extent, but also figures from the House and the Senate like George Bender and Kenneth Wherry had the same types of concerns. So Taft was critical of the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and NATO. He thought all of these were unnecessarily provocative or ruinously expensive. That's Robert A. Taft, who in his day was known as Mr. Republican. So that's not what you would expect, is it? That's not what the cartoon version of history would lead you to believe. The thinking was that communism was bound to collapse of its own weight, and if the international communist system wanted to run around the world and grab this or that part of Africa or this or that Asian country and exhaust itself pouring resources into it, go ahead. And then meanwhile, the United States can have a reputation for being anti-imperialist, staying out of these sorts of things, and can become a rallying point for developing countries that aren't particularly fond of communist takeovers, but also don't really want to be taken over by the U.S. either. But of course, this was not the majority position. This was not the position I held as a middle school and high school student in the 1980s. But it was Rothbard's view, and it was the view of a minority of libertarians. And it meant that the two sides just considered the matter irreconcilable. And so Rothbard, as many of you know, spent the 1960s fluttering around trying to find anybody he could make common cause with against the Vietnam War. And it's worth noting, by the way, that the John Birch Society was against the Vietnam War. Now, how interesting is that? You would think the John Birch Society, they're super right-wing and they're against the international communist conspiracy. They were against the Vietnam War. So it wasn't until the Cold War came to an end that Rothbard felt he could make his return to where he felt like he belonged, which was among people on the right. That doesn't mean he agrees with everybody on the right. He thought for sure that a great many of them did not understand economics the way they should. They had a number of positions that needed to be corrected, but he still felt a kind of kinship with them. And that's kind of how I feel. I used to call myself a conservative, and then the conservative movement made it too embarrassing to keep using that term. Now I feel like the libertarian movement is doing the same for libertarians. I don't know what to do. But I still have, you know, conservative instincts that I think are quite reconcilable with libertarianism. And just libertarianism is just saying you can't use physical violence against people. You can't initiate it against people. That's it. It doesn't have any position, as Rothbard said, it doesn't have any position on culture, aesthetics, religion, any of these other topics. It simply has to do with the use of violence in society and where it should be considered morally acceptable. That's it. Outside of that, you can be as conservative or left-wing as you want, as long as you stick to that principle. So I still feel a certain kinship with the best of the conservatives, we'll say that. So anyway, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute was created at a time, and again, as I say, it had a different name at the beginning, when the situation was a bit more fluid between conservatives and libertarians. And there was a lot of overlap in where they would get their articles published and in terms of friendships and so on. So anyway, I was there as part of a two-person panel with Dan McCarthy. And as I said, Dan McCarthy has been a guest here a number of times. Dan is a Buchananite conservative. He supported Trump. Yet Dan, even though he doesn't agree with me on everything, unlike most critics of libertarianism that I encounter, Dan has thoroughly read the background material. Most of the time, especially coming from progressives, I feel like they have no idea what we think. The only people they can think of in our tradition are Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand. That they've never heard of Ludwig von Mises. They've never heard of Murray Rothbard. They don't know any of these names. So I don't even consider it worth my time to talk to them. Dan knows the material inside and out, and he's very, very respectful of it. And he introduced me to these students who, these students did not know me. And I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, but this is the first time in over 10 years where I've been at an event with students and they don't know who I am. They're in a completely different intellectual world. But Dan wanted to bring me in basically because he says they've never encountered a libertarian who isn't a coward or a leftist. So I thought it might be interesting for them to talk to you. So I spoke to them. And by the end, I had them laughing and cheering me on. So it went really well. And I introduced them to Murray Rothbard. Because by the end, they want to know, well, what can we read in your tradition of thought? I love this. These kids are readers. Because as I was giving my talk, I would mention book titles. And to my great pleasure and astonishment, I saw them furiously writing these book titles down. I said, oh, yes, baby, yes, woohoo. So then I said, all right, well, I can't give you a full-blown treatise from this particular wing of libertarianism, but you'll get a real kick out of The Irrepressible Rothbard, which is a collection of his early 1990s writings. Not his scholarly material, but just you really get the raw, unfiltered Rothbard, and you guys are just going to love it. And they're furiously writing this down. And then I told them, you also need to Google and read his speech called A Strategy for the Right. It's a speech he gave in 1992. It's one of the best things I've ever read. I was not present to hear the speech, but I've read it, and it is darn good. And only later did I remember that in that speech, he's very critical of William F. Buckley Jr., who was the first president of ISI. Now, I was not trying to be cheeky in referring them to that speech. I forgot about that part, but I probably would have referred them to it anyway. Now, incidentally, I said at one point in talking to them that back in 2008, when we had that terrible financial crisis, we were very much on the defensive. And when I say we, I mean both conservatives and libertarians, because we're both perceived as defenders of the market economy. And wasn't this a failure of the market economy? Hadn't capitalism failed us? And I said to these kids, let me tell you something. I wrote a book on this called Meltdown, and they're frantically writing Meltdown. They're writing this down. That defended the free market, that said this is not a failure of the free market. And I talked about central banking. I talked about the Federal Reserve System. You cannot discuss this issue without talking about the policies of the central bank. And when you do that, you realize that it's this and not the free market, in quotation marks, that's responsible for what happened. And I just flat out said to them, you guys in the conservative movement, I said, now, not you in particular, because you're all so young, you weren't even aware this was even happening at the time. But I'll just say you in general were not very convincing in how you addressed the financial crisis of 2008. The conservative movement did a lousy job of it because the conservative movement never talks about the Federal Reserve. So how are they going to account for what happened in 2008? Well, you would get all these strained arguments about the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977. 1977, and that accounts for something that happened in 2008. Come on. That's the best you can do. Well, that is the best you can do when you neglect the elephant in the room, which is the Federal Reserve. Because, oh, only cranks talk about the Federal Reserve. That's a crackpot thing to talk about. No, it's not, actually. No, it's not. It's very important to talk about it. And only by talking about it can you make sense of it. Can you make sense of what happened? So I said to them, you guys needed the libertarians to bail you out. And I said, and that's why my book landed me on every right-wing program you can imagine, because they said to themselves, finally, somebody who has a half-persuasive argument about what happened here. So I did make clear that, you know, we have things to teach them that they ought to listen to. So it was fun. But the thing that I remember most about it is something I told them toward the end. And I was thinking about this because my panel was after lunch, and we had a lunch speaker. The lunch speaker was a very impressive guy, Johnny Burtka, who is president and CEO of ISI. And this was my first time meeting him. He's only 31. And man, does he have his head screwed on right. And he was giving a talk that more or less amounted to some very useful life advice. And a lot of these kinds of talks are just useless, empty platitudes. But this was really good. There were some bits and pieces in there that I thought to myself, I could stand to apply this in my life. So he had 31, and he said it's by an interesting coincidence, he's 31 years old. He had 31 principles that people ought to bear in mind. And as I was finishing up my remarks, I thought, I think there's a number 32 that these particular people in this room need to hear. And it was this: be prepared to be hated. Now, that's very hard to hear. Nobody wants to be hated. And I think the left knows that and exploits that. And that's what it's doing when it calls people racists or, heaven forbid, white supremacists and all the rest of it, or bigots or all that stuff. I think some of them probably realize that the people they're talking to are not actually any of these things. I think we've all caught on to that now. But they know it stings, because to a normal, decent human being, being told that you are a terrible person who wishes other people ill arbitrarily is a hard thing to hear. And it's a hard thing to have the whole world told it. So-and-so is a this, so-and-so is a that. And your first instinct is to say, no, wait a minute, no, why are you saying that about me? Why are you saying that? That's terrible. And then you want to start explaining yourself and putting things in context and saying, well, look, you're just making the most uncharitable interpretation possible of things I've done and said in my life. And they're obviously incompatible with these other things I've done and said. So why don't you? And you wind up doing this. And sometimes you even wind up apologizing. No, 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 no. And as somebody who, I have not apologized for things I've done in the past. Sometimes I've clarified things. But even that I shouldn't have done. I should have told these people to go jump in a lake. I really should have told them to go screw themselves. Because these are not people of goodwill. The mistake people who are attacked like this make is that they assume that the attackers, who seem really upset, must be upset by something real, or that they think is real. Like, they must really think I'm a racist. Because you think to yourself, it would take a lot for me to get as angry as they are at me right now. So they must think I've done some horrible thing for them to get this upset. But no, 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 no. No. You shouldn't project your thoughts onto them, because you're attributing to them thoughts and motives that they don't have. They're not really concerned that you actually want black people to have separate water fountains or anything like that. They don't actually think that. But they know this stings, and they know it'll damage your reputation, and they know it'll put you on the defensive. That's why they do it. It has absolutely nothing to do with justice or anything like that. If it did, then they would accept a sincere apology. But a sincere apology only makes them swarm, because now they've smelled blood and now they're going to move in for the kill, because now they realize they have a weakling on their hands. Of course, there's a certain applicability of this to the Joe Rogan situation. I think Joe Rogan, who seems non-ideological to me, is a basically decent person. And so when he's viciously attacked, he naturally thinks, wow, they must really think I'm X, Y, or Z for them to be attacking me this harshly, because for me to attack somebody else that harshly, I would have to think something really, really bad about them. So again, he's thinking that they act the way he acts, or they have the same thoughts that he has, but they don't. They're not acting out of goodwill. These are people who will misrepresent you, take things out of context, show doctored clips to make you look bad, on and on and on. They'll never give your side of the story. They'll act like you don't have a side of the story. They want to destroy you, and they know that this particular avenue is a promising one. It works. And so I said to these kids, be prepared to be hated. And that is a hard thing because no one wants to be hated. At the very least, you want to be respected. You want people to say, well, I may not agree with that person, but wow, that's a smart person. That's a hardworking person. That person makes us think. That person raises interesting issues. Even if he comes down on the wrong side, he forces us to clarify our own thinking. That just doesn't happen, unfortunately. I'd love to have that happen. It just doesn't. It's so rare. Our side does it sometimes. I'll say, I love Glenn Greenwald, even though I disagree with him on a lot of things. I think he's really good. In the areas where he's good, he's really good. But it's very rarely reciprocated. Now, Glenn is very good about that, but it's very rarely reciprocated. Because we're sitting here waiting for left-wingers to say, you know, you got to hand it to those libertarians. They may be wrong on X and Y, but they're really great on Z. It just doesn't happen. Almost never happens. And we kind of crave that as human beings. We want approval from people. But unfortunately, that's just not coming. Especially if you're going to go into politics, being somebody who craves the approval of others and craves the approval of people with big microphones in society is a very, very dangerous person to have at the levers of power, because they'll throw it all away, everything they said they believed in exchange for approval. And I said to these kids, it's not easy. This is not for everyone. Not everyone is cut out for this. Imagine being hated by every major institution in America, the corporate CEOs, the mainline churches, the entertainment world, the media, the political class. Everywhere you turn, you are hated and despised. Of course, the educational establishment, you just go on and on. And it's going to be very, very tempting sometime down the road to write that article for The Atlantic, why I am no longer a conservative or why I am no longer a libertarian. And just beat your breast and say, oh, if only I had known what you wise people at The Atlantic know, I wouldn't have made such gross errors in my life. But thank goodness I am no longer like such men. And now I am, it's going to be very tempting to write that article. Don't do that. Don't do that. You may look out into the world and feel like you're all alone. You may look out there and feel like absolutely everyone hates your guts and wants you destroyed. But don't forget all those silent people, the many, many, many silent people out there who have your back, who support you, who believe in what you believe, and don't ever betray those people. I mean, it's hard just living in a society like this, knowing how hated you are and how much contempt your ideas are held in, but then to actually be out there fighting in the world of ideas, it's orders of magnitude worse. And you've just got to buck up your courage and be prepared for that. Hey everybody, let's take just a minute to remind you that there are so many things that people can struggle with, like anxiety and depression and stress and relationship issues, and they afflict us for so long and so regularly that we come to assume that this is just part of life, that there's nothing we can do about this. This is just our fate. In fact, we're so caught in it that the very question of whether it could be avoided, whether there's anything that could be done about it, sometimes doesn't even cross our minds. Well, Woods is here to tell you that there is help in the form of our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will figure out exactly what it is you need, match you up with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in what you need. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can check out the ton of testimonials on their website. And by the way, just in case they don't fix you up with your perfect therapeutic match, they'll get you another one. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, help.com/woods. Now, then I had an opportunity to appear on their podcast, and if I can get that recording, I'm going to use that as an episode of the Tom Woods Show. And likewise, if I can get the panel, and it was just a conversation between Dan and me, really. If I can get the recording of that, I think you'll find that very interesting, because Dan and I had areas of agreement, and we had areas of disagreement, and we talked about big tech and what ought to be done. There's about that, if anything. So it was a really, really interesting conversation where we both conceded things to the other. We were friendly to the other. It was wonderful. By the way, I'll never forget, back around, maybe it was about 10 years ago, maybe it was around 2012, I was having a meal in a restaurant with Dan, and he said to me, and he said this out of friendship, like the Aristotelian idea of friendship, that you should will what is good for the other. He said to me, "Tom, your writing is just too sarcastic. It's too biting and stinging. And you really got to do something about that. I mean, it's just, you cannot continue like this." I appreciated that. I appreciated that that was something I'm sure wasn't easy for him to tell me, but it was coming from somebody who really wanted what was best for me. Nobody really likes hearing criticism. So this doesn't mean that now I urge all of you to send me emails telling me how bad I am in various parts of my life. But I appreciated this because sometimes I'm surrounded by yes men. You know, they just, everything I do, they approve of. But this, I thought, took guts, and it showed that he was a real friend to me. Now, I completely ignored him. I continued to write exactly the same way, but it was still very heartfelt, and I was very glad to have somebody like Dan. I told him about this past weekend. He has no recollection of this conversation at all. And he said, well, maybe over the years I changed my mind. I said, yeah, maybe in the age of Trump you realized, hey, there's something to old Woods' writing style after all. Well, anyway, so I made an appearance while I was there on ISI's podcast. And at the end, they asked me what conservatism means to me. How do I define it? And I said, you know, in the old days, like in the 1980s, politicians would define conservatism as something like a free market economy, a strong national defense, and family values. And I said, that is just sloganeering from the 1980s that should remain in the 1980s. I said, much, much more than anything like that, it simply means this: a respect for the inherited wisdom of the past. That's what it means. Now, it doesn't mean that the past is always right, that the past never needs to be corrected. It also doesn't mean that it's impossible for people to have been wrong for a very long time on very important things. That's not impossible either. But it is a dose of humility against the arrogance we are all liable to, because we're all very impressed by the knowledge we have in our own individual brains. And that is liable to steer us badly, because there were a lot of brains that came before us. And we may be tempted to think we can just remake the whole world on the basis of the reasoning ability in our brains. But the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the 20th century totalitarian revolutions have demonstrated what that leads to. And of course, if you're going to remake a society from scratch, it's almost impossible for that process not to be brutal. What do you do with all the people who are rather fond of the previous society that you're trying to replace? What's going to happen to them? Well, we know what happens to them. We've seen it. So conservatism is saying, and Michael Malice has sometimes shared a maxim of G.K. Chesterton along these lines, saying something like this, that if you have a house, some of the walls are there just to separate the rooms, but other walls are there to support the whole structure. So before you go say, well, I've spent 10 minutes studying this institution and I don't understand what the need for it is. Well, okay, but that's a really, really juvenile and arrogant way to think, because maybe that institution is a supporting wall of the whole civilization. Before you knock it down, you better investigate to make sure we really, really don't need it. And I think this is a very, very helpful cautionary principle for all of us to remember, that there is some wisdom that comes to us from the past. We shouldn't just be contemptuous of it and think they were all stupid and racist and backward and ignorant and superstitious, and if only they could be more like us today. Shut up for a minute and listen. You know, people who talk like this, this woke language, are ones who just never stop talking. Shut up for a minute and listen and learn, because there is more to life. There is more to the world. There is more to society and human flourishing than what you've managed to eke out in the 40 years of your life or whatever. I think it's very, very important, and it's a very mature way to think, and it's why I can never repudiate conservatism, because I think it has something very valuable to say to us, even if sometimes, as with libertarianism, its spokesmen are, shall we say, less than ideal. All right, that's going to do it for today. Let me tell you what I'm going to try to cover this week. Also, later in the week, we're going to talk about the Canadian convoy situation. So we're going to get somebody on from Canada to talk about that. Then, coming to us from the UK, our old friend James Dellingpole is coming back to the podcast. I just love this guy. This guy is truly fearless and hilarious. And I hope that normality returns soon, if only so that I can go over to London. I don't know where James lives, but you can get to pretty much anywhere in England without too much trouble. I want to get over there and meet him and have lunch. So let's hope that happens. But he's a absolutely great, devastating, killer commentator who's been so good throughout this terrible time. So I've got great things coming up. And if you like what you hear on The Tom Woods Show, and you feel like it is giving you some value, then I would be very grateful if you became a supporting listener of the show. And I try to meet you halfway by giving you back a whole lot of great things that you would enjoy as bonuses as a supporting listener of The Tom Woods Show. So check that out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.